Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
Offensive linemen oftentimes don't get the love in the game of football. They're the guys that do all the dirty work for the skill players, the guys that wear the larger numbers and don't look as good in front of the camera. And oftentimes people don't even know what they look like. But that's what makes their stories even better, because they're in the trenches. They're right there for every key play. As part of the Professional Football Researchers Association podcast, we've had the pleasure to talk to a number of players thus far and even former coaches, like on our previous episodes, like a Wayne Fonts, who coached for the Detroit Lions. We talked to Mark Miller, a quarterback who played for the Browns and the Packers. But on this episode, we discuss the idea of an offensive lineman with you, and that's Ed White, the former Minnesota Viking and former San Diego Charger, who had the chance to tell us his stories and tell us a little bit more about what made his career special. There's some great stories in here, too, stuff that you will not want to miss from our discussion with Ed White. George and I had such a great time picking his brain and talking to him about everything that he did over his really very long career, from stories involving Dan Fouts and the Chargers and Don Coryell, to even the stories about Bud Grant and what it was like to play in Minnesota, and what was it like to play in back-to-back games, the game against the Miami Dolphins, and then the game the next week in Cincinnati when it was so cold that, well, people still have frostbite till this day that we're at that game in the early 80s. Ed White, our guest on the Professional Football Researchers Association podcast as part of the Sports History Network.
Former Minnesota Viking, former San Diego Charger. They were the San Diego Chargers back then, where they should rightfully be still today. And that is Ed White, a great offensive lineman in his time in the league. And Ed, we're so tickled to have you on the show tonight and have you as part of this. And thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, guys. Thank you, John and George. I appreciate it. And I'm proud to be a part of your group.
So let's discuss football for you, Ed. Obviously, you carved out a pretty darn good career. I believe it was 4 Pro Bowls that you found yourself in the time that you were in the league. And you really, as I said, you carved out some special things. You played for some special teams. But let's go back before that. I ask almost every guest that we have that was a player this, and I want to ask you this. What drove you to the game of football? Was it a parent? Was it a family member? Was it the violence of the game? What was it that drove you to wanting to be a football player, Ed?
It was just the love of being out there and playing football as a small boy in the street. And I played until we had to go inside and have dinner, and if we got hurt and started crying, we'd have to go in early, so we never got hurt. And I ended up growing up in San Diego, and on the weekends, a bunch of us would gather at the junior high school and play on a little patch of grass, and 5 or 6 of us ended up getting major college scholarships. We'd all moved away to different places, but just the things we learned, just playing together without any adult leadership or anything, we built a lot of the things you needed to succeed.
There is a certain kind of rigidness to the game, and there's a certain amount of discipline to the game that you kind of learn at a young age, isn't there? Did that kind of find its way through you guys as you guys were growing up playing on the playground?
I think so. I think that it's a lot of pride. You know, when you're just with your peers, the pressure is so much greater if it's put on by yourself than if it's put on by somebody else. And I think that the pressure you put on yourself just to be outstanding amongst your buddies is probably the greatest pressure you could have. And I look back on that, and you know, there not only did five guys go to major colleges and play ball, but three or four of us played pro ball, and it's just amazing statistic.
That is truly amazing. I know of a similar situation here in Northeast Ohio. There's a little village called East Canton. It's now a little township, and there's like three or four guys that grew up a couple houses away from each other, and they were kind of the same situation as you, and they all kind of kept track of each other as they were rising up through the game. But who was your first influence then? I mean, obviously you playing with the guys on the playground is big, but which coach was the first influence for you? Or was it a teacher? Was it a parent? Who was it that influenced you to becoming the player that you were?
Well, I think that I had a really outstanding junior high school coach. We didn't play football in junior high school, but we played on the playground and did different things. And he was just a superhuman being. And I just aspired to be like him as a person and treat people, you know, with respect. And he taught me a lot. And then growing up, you know, I was very fortunate. If I work backwards, my career in the NFL was what it was because, first of all, I played for two of the best coaches to coach in football, Don Coryell and Bud Grant. And those guys, they knew how to take care of the players. They were both players, outstanding athletes, and both just exemplary people as examples, and treated us as players. And they didn't beat us up. Minnesota Bud, we came in training camp last. New Orleans had been in training camp 3 months earlier, and half of them were on the injured reserve list before the first game. And we came in 6 weeks before our first preseason game, and we were healthy as could be all season long and ready for the playoffs. And that went a long way. And Don, it was the same way. He was a special person, treated us, as adults, as Bud did, and we responded as adults, and played hard for him. And he was funny and fun, and we loved it. And I'm so happy to see him go in the Hall of Fame this year.
Ed, before you got to the pros, you played your college ball at Berkeley, and you were an All-American there. Can you tell us something about your college experience on the gridiron?
Well, I went to Berkeley, which was, I was in Southern California at the time in the desert at Indio High School, where I went to school, flying into the Bay Area was like flying into Shangri-La. It was beautiful, and Berkeley was a beautiful campus. It's, you know, it's a lot like stepping on Notre Dame's campus or Penn State. It's gorgeous, green, beautiful. And I fell in love with it and the academics. I studied architecture and then ended up in landscape architecture. And I really enjoyed that experience. I had Ray Wilsey as my head coach, and Bill Dunton was my position coach. I was a defensive tackle. And he was all about technique and being a technician. And I loved that. And that served me well as a coach and a player, because to me, technique is most of the game, you know, being a good technician.
Ed White is our guest, former San Diego Charger and Minnesota Viking, and he's a member of the Professional Football Researchers Association Hall of Very Good. If you would like to go to the PFRA website and read about him, he is in the Hall of Very Good. And I want to kind of approach that subject a little bit with you, Ed, early on here, because I was reading before we got on here that Dan Fouts, your quarterback, has been very vocal that you should have a gold jacket that has your name on it. when you hear that, when you see a guy who's got a gold jacket, has a bust in Canton, hear that and say that about you, what does that mean to you? And how do you feel about that situation? I'm curious to know.
Well, to me, that's a the most important thing. It becomes a popularity type of thing. And I don't know that I was that popular, but I know that, you know, Dan and people that I played with and against, a lot of the people have written Bob Lilly, Bob Brown, the guys that I respect and I played against have said wonderful things. And that means as much to me as anything, to tell you the truth. And so it's like, you know, when it's left up to a lot of people to make a vote, then, you know, offensive line is not a position a lot of people focus on.
Ed, you mentioned Bob Lilly and Bob Brown there. Who was the toughest defensive lineman that you came up against? And you said, geez, I got to be at the top of my game against this guy.
Well, those are two of them right there. I was really fortunate in both San Diego and Minnesota. In Minnesota, I practiced against Alan Page every day. And when Sunday came around, there wasn't too many people that were quicker than Alan. And so and smarter, you know, Alan's a judge now. And so I retired. But, just a brilliant guy. And unbelievable athlete, and so that honed my skills pretty good. And Louis Kelcher in San Diego was a different kind of, he was a big animal, and so that prepared me for that type of person. So I had a well-rounded group of guys to work against, and that has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, not many guys get to practice. I mean, I'm sure the guys in Pittsburgh probably felt the same way going against the Steel Curtain in practice every day, but you got a chance to go against the Purple People Eaters every day in practice. That had to make Sundays a little bit easier, didn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, on Wednesday we went pretty good. And so in fact, we kind of beat each other up, and Bud moved me to right from left guard to right guard, because Alan and I were beating each other up. And so he said, "Yeah, you don't need to beat Alan up anymore, and he doesn't need to beat you up, and you'll be playing next to your buddy Ron Yeary, and you'll get more attention." I said, "Well, that's fine." And so I played the end of my career at right guard, playing next to Ron.
Yeah, tell me about Ron. I've had the pleasure to interview Ron one time when he was in Canton at the Hall of Fame, and he's like double the size of me. His hand basically eats mine when he tries to shake it. But tell me about playing next to Ron. I mean, you and him going toe-to-toe against each other, next to each other like that. What was that like, having another awesome lineman right next to you?
Oh, it was fantastic. We did a lot of team blocking and cross blocking, and we just, we complimented each other. We studied together. We sat together when we watched film, and we really, we worked together well. He's my neighbor now. He moved out here from Texas. He's about five houses down the street, and we're enjoying each other's company again, but it was a real pleasure.
Ed, you had the opportunity to protect some big names at quarterback, starting with Joe Capp, and then obviously Fran Tarkington, and then you've already mentioned Dan Fouts. What was that like? What were the differences in terms of the protection of those kind of quarterbacks?
Well, they were all different. The protection for Dan and for Joe was similar. Joe was a better athlete than he looked like on film. In fact, he was a great athlete. He took Cal to the champion NCAA. I don't know if they went to the finals, but he was the captain of the basketball team. He took him to the Rose Bowl. The only time I think Cal's been in the Rose Bowl, he was a quarterback. He was a good athlete. He took a lot of heat for throwing the ducks and all that, but he was as good an athlete as he was a fabulous leader. And he led by example. He'd be the first guy to stick his nose in there, jump over somebody and knock him out, like he did Dale Lindsey in one of the playoff games. He was just a tough son of a gun and a great guy. And I love Joe, and sorry to, see him go this year. And he was a good friend. And, And then Tarkington, you know, amazing. He was the athlete of the bunch, and he could move and he could get you out of trouble. He very rarely would get sacked. Oftentimes we wouldn't know where he was sitting up. He was moving around back there so athletically, but he was a great leader. Like I said, I was fortunate to play for the coaches that surrounded me with fantastic people. And that's one of them. You know, when we were having issues at quarterback, when Joe was at the end of his career, he went and got Fran, you know, and Coach Coryell, you know, had Dan and took care of him and used him in a way that fit the things that he had in mind to move the football. And that's, Don was, a genius at moving the ball with Ernie Zampezi.
You know, I think people remember, obviously, Ron being next to you on the line, but on the other side was Mick Tinglehoff. And I think a lot of people kind of underappreciate Mick. I know he went into the Hall of Fame a couple years ago, but just speak about Mick, because I saw him in Canton when he had kind of like lost his wits a little bit about him. And it was kind of sad to not be able to talk to him. But tell me about Mick. Tell me what it was like playing next to him and just the warrior that he was. Cause I heard he never missed.
You're not going to say that about me after this interview, are you, John?
No. Okay. Nothing like that.
Just kidding. Mick was a fantastic friend and human being. He was a guy that didn't say much. He was a Nebraskan through and through. I married a Nebraskan, so I could say that. And Mick was a beauty. He was just a fantastic human being. Those guys treated me, I started right off the bat. The starting guard got appendicitis, and I started the first four games of our first Super Bowl year, 69 against the Chiefs. And played against a lot of good guys. Played against Bob Lilly is one of them. And I was a defensive lineman that, you know, had a training camp to get ready at offensive guard. And all those guys, Mick and Grady Alderman, and Joe Capp, they didn't make me feel like they were concerned at all about a rookie that played defensive tackle starting the season for him. And that gave me so much confidence, in what I had to contribute.
You mentioned Alan Page. He came up a lot early on there with a guy that you got to go against, but I mean, you played the Chiefs, you went against Willie Lanier. You played the Cowboys, you went against Bob Lilly. Was there one guy that stood out above anybody else that you played against in a game that was like tougher than anybody? And you're like, that's a tough SOB.
Well, I tell you, when the middle linebackers are Ray Nitschke, Willie Lanier, I could go on and on. And the defensive linemen were Bob Lilly, Bob Brown. It was a week after week. There just wasn't any drop off. They were all studs. And most importantly, they were all intelligent guys. I mean, the smarter the guy, the better the guy. I mean, they knew. I felt like Bob Lilly knew what I was doing before I did it. As soon as I moved a muscle, it just co-signed what Bob had already figured out through watching me and watching film. And all the great ones had that ability. Alan had that ability. Bob Brown, all those guys had that ability. And they were all blessed with some, Bob Brown was just a he-man, he was just brutal. And Willie Lanier was like hitting an oak tree. I mean, he just didn't move. So anyway, take your pick. They're all great.
Ed, you had the opportunity to play in four Super Bowls. And I know in the 70s, I sort of feel like growing up in that same era, I was born in the 50s, but I always felt that the Super Bowl was really developing during that time frame. Now it's this huge extravaganza.
Right.
Not to say it wasn't then, but
yeah, it was.
what was that experience like? Because, you know, some hope to play in one. You played in four. What was that experience like, the buildup, actually being there and being part of that?
I think that, you know, Bud protected us so much, and nothing against the press, but we weren't allowed to spend much time around the press during the football season. And he didn't allow them in the locker room. And like a lot of teams let them come in and they kind of take over. The locker room was our sanctuary. If you wanted to talk to one of the guys, you had to get a time. So there wasn't as much contact. And all of a sudden, and we didn't do a lot of things outside of the team. And all of a sudden, and it was big back then, you know, even a lot different than it is now, but it was still huge. And you'd go and you'd sit at a table, you'd be surrounded by 20 or 30 reporters from all over the world, cameras going, and all of a sudden, you know, these little guys from Minnesota that have been living in a closet are exposed to that. And I don't think we were that prepared for that as football players. I remember the Raiders and how they kind of, it was tongue in cheek with them, and they Madden let them go out and have fun and blah, blah, blah. And we were pretty rigid in all of them. And, I don't know. I mean, you get beat, you get beat. And so we were beaten by better teams, maybe at that moment, not to say that we couldn't have beat them at another time, but something wasn't right. And we had great teams. And it's a shame we didn't, capture one of those.
Do you think, you mentioned the word rigid, do you think that was part of playing for somebody like Bud Grant? Because I always look at you played for two, well, you played for a Hall of Fame coach in Bud Grant, and Don Coryell is going to go in the Hall of Fame this year. So you played for two Hall of Fame coaches. And I guess from my viewpoint, I always looked at Bud Grant during that time frame as being sort of a stoic, quiet leader, but serious. Whereas I think the press and everything else always pointed to Coryell as sort of being more cerebral because of the offense and Eric Coryell and everything else. Is that an accurate assessment of the two coaches? Or
yeah, that's pretty close, George. But Coryell was he was on the edge. He was a little crazy. So he kept you on your toes too, because he was serious about winning football, I'll tell you that. And he knew how to get the right group together to do that. So he was as serious about winning and doing football right as Bud was. That's for sure. But Bud was different. Yeah, Bud was not warm and fuzzy. You know, he was consistent, and he always to me he was like General Patton. He was like a general, a great general in our military. That's how I felt like Bud was. Coryell was like the Mad Hatter.
When you played in San Diego, you played in two rather famous games. And I'm going to turn it over to John because he's looking at me, because I think he was going to ask the same question I was.
Yeah, okay. No, I was – no, great minds, I guess like father, like son in this case.
good segue.
It is, but I was going to ask you, I mean, you play in the game against the Dolphins, that marathon game where Kellen Winslow gets carried off the field, and then the next week you have to recoup your body to be able to go into Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati when it was what, like -1,000 degrees that day? So yeah. I mean, what was that like back to back? Could you even feel your body after those 2 weeks?
Well, the Miami game was it just sapped you, and I was lockering next to Louis Kelcher, who was probably 350, and Louis, had to carry that around. It was a lot bigger chore for him than it was for me, but I was still totally sapped. And I'll never forget, I was sitting in front of my locker, exhausted, and Louis is getting interviewed. And the guy interviews Louis and finishes, and then turns to me with the microphone and said, "Ed, how did you feel after this game?" And I said, "Oh," Louis said he felt like he rode horseback from Texas to California. And he said, "Ed, how do you feel?" I said, "I feel like the horse that Louis rode." anyway, it was funny. You had to be there.
And it's a great quote.
Yeah, well, that was my best line, so I had to use it tonight. But that's how exhausted I was. And the other one was like, that game shouldn't have been played. And they tried to move it, and, Paul Brown would have nothing to do with it. He insisted that game be played in that condition, and it shouldn't have been. It really shouldn't have been. And a lot of our guys, in fact, Dan has frostbite today because of it. A lot of guys got frostbite. It was just too cold to play a game. You couldn't think. You didn't want to hit anybody. It was your body ached, and it affected both teams, but I think it affected us more because what I learned is the fair weather teams, having played in Minnesota, worry more about the weather conditions in the teams that play outside in weather, and it defocuses them, which it did us. We were more concerned about what kind of gloves are we going to wear, and they're talking about scuba gloves and all. We were, as players, they were more concerned about how you're going to stay warm than how are you going to block Alan Page or, Dick Butkus or whatever. And it's a big advantage when you play outside and practice outside like we did in Minnesota. And I think they lost that edge when they went inside.
George, go ahead.
Ed, following your football career, I found it very interesting as I was researching about your life as an artist. And I know the other day when we first talked and we were trying to get a hold of each other, you were at a retreat at the Oak Lake Art Center, which I know is something that is a fondness in your heart. Can you tell us about, the transition from your football career to becoming an artist and some of the things that you've done? Because I know that you said you were working with youth over this past weekend. I saw some pictures online with you and an ex-Browns player, Jerry Shirk. Can you tell us a little bit about your art career?
Well, I've always been an artist, and I didn't major in art. I majored in architecture and landscape architecture, but art has always been important to me as a small boy, and it remains so. I'm actually doing a big commission for a couple of players. George Kuntz has commissioned me to do a large piece for him, and John Beasley, my tight end at Minnesota. So I just had my total hip replaced, so I've kind of I haven't been out in the studio. So those guys, I'm sorry, guys, it's taken longer, but anyhow, art has always been important, and so I share it with young people, And I do a lot. I've done a lot of work with Jerry Shirk has worked with a lot of young kids that have had the misfortune of, being in the drug courts and different things. And I've done a lot of that, a lot of Boys and Girls Clubs. And I teach them how to paint with acrylic. I mean, a lot of people never get a chance to paint acrylic in their whole life. And here are these kids. I went, I spent 2 days. My son's a principal of a summer school that mostly Hispanic kids in the desert. And my wife, Joanne, and I went down and did a 2-day class with 50 kids, and their paintings were fantastic. And they ranged from third grade to fifth grade. And it wore us out. I'm not sure how many more times I can do that, but it's really rewarding to look at them and to see, them create something that they're proud of. And, it's like in our house, I have 3 paintings on the wall that each of our kids did growing up around that age. And I'm sure these are going to go up on the wall of their parents' home. And so it's a very enlightening experience for me and my wife and Jerry Shirk and Brian Seip also joins in. Brian's an artist and an architect, and Brian goes with me sometimes, and it's a fun thing.
That's really cool to hear that that art has obviously taken such a big role in your life. What else do you do then, Ed, to try to promote the arts and try to promote that for generations coming up? And what can you do to, because I mean, obviously a lot of people think of you as the football player and they're probably like, oh, he wants people to play football. But are the arts almost a little bit more important to you now than maybe the game of football was?
Well, you know, when I was in the game of football, no, but you know, now that I don't, football, you know, it strokes your ego, you know, a lot, but not to the point where I don't think about it a lot. And you know, I watch it because I think it's exciting. I think I like the fact that the young kids are making more of the pie than we did, fortunately, because, you know, I'm a perfect example of, you know, having my hip replaced. I need to have a shoulder replaced. I mean, of how you end up when you're in your 70s and maybe earlier, you need to be reciprocated for it if they're making the kind of money they make, period. And so I'm happy for those kids. Sometimes I wish they acted a little better, but, you know, you can't control that. We acted crazy some of the time too, but I think that I think it's fair and I think it's good. And I think the game, they're making it safer. They practice differently. Their rules are different. And I think it's all positive. I think you don't need to be cutting people down and getting in their legs. And you know, the knees are important for your life, for the rest of your life. And your body. And I think that's all good. So I'm happy the way it's gone. And I think they got a great game. I think those kids are flying around and knocking the crap out of each other, just like we did.
You know, our previous podcast guest was a guy by the name of Jeff Nixon, played for the Buffalo Bills. I see you shaking your head already.
I know Jeff. Yeah.
You might know where this is going. He told us to tell you.
Okay.
And this is, don't shoot the messenger here, because he just told us to tell you this.
Try dirty.
He said Ed White ended his football career. That's what he claimed.
How?
He said you and him fell in the same direction and you fell on his leg. He told us to give you crap about it and razz you about it a little bit.
He said it was mostly tongue in cheek.
Well, tell him if he was a better athlete, he wouldn't be on the ground. No, Jeff's a good one. I never intentionally hurt anybody. I my goal as a player was to go 100%. From the sit to the end until the whistle, and I went full speed. I never tried to hurt anybody, but I tried to beat up everybody.
It's a good attitude to have as an offensive lineman. Ed White, our guest, former Minnesota Viking, former San Diego Charger, all around great guy. We've been lucky, George. I know you had another question.
Ed, I wanted to ask this earlier. When you were at Berkeley, you were there during the 60s, obviously, a period of, you know, as you know, unrest in the country. Did you experience any of that while you were at Berkeley?
Oh, yeah. But I was a conservative person, and actually most of the people that I hung around with were conservative. Most of the demonstrators were not students. They were people that would come on campus and create havoc. And sure, there was a percentage of students, but most of the people that I knew were not involved in that. In fact, I would take my drawing board, and I did a lot of, in fact, I did a painting of a picture that I drew of the riots with Mario Savio, and they carrying this. I was there. So I drew a sketch of it, and I did a painting for a friend of mine, my roommate that was the head of the alumni, he retired now. And I did a full blown painting of that for him. And so I witnessed it and watched it. And, it shaped some things for me, because I think, you know, like the war, I think there are reasons to go to war sometimes, but there might be reasons that you know, maybe we go for other reasons other than, you know, and so it makes you look at things and go, hey, what are we doing there in Vietnam? Are we doing something for us or them, or is it for our economy or whatever? It makes you just think about it, not to draw any conclusions, but it makes you question some things. And that's what I think Berkeley did for me. But I was relatively conservative about my thinking.
You know, you mentioned something earlier that I also wanted to touch on with you, Ed, because I think this is something that so many guys that played football in the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s have discussed is player safety and how the game has changed. When we did talk to Jeff on the previous podcast, he said he remembers a day in time where, you know, the team medic would basically just throw pills at you until something stuck and you started feeling better. Can you speak to what that kind of wild, wild west was like that you maybe played in, where it was that sense of, hey, you got a headache, or hey, you got an arm that's hurting, let's just throw pills at you until you feel better? What was that like, and how have you seen it change over the years?
Well, I think it's as you know, the knowledge of medicine and how you, and sports medicine particularly. I mean, I'm not sure it was a career back then even, and these guys have come a long way, and I think all that is part of the progress that goes. But yeah, there was, you know, you'd get, you know, it wasn't uncommon for you, if you had something wrong, they'd give you a shot of Novocaine or something to numb the pain. You know, I'm not sure they do those kind of things this day and age, but who knows? I think they're a lot more conservative about putting you back on the field if there's a chance that there's something wrong. But I've had, you know, rib situations where they shot the ribs up and you go back out there. Well, I might have had a broken rib that might have punctured a lung. Hey, who knows? You know, I don't know. I'm sure today it's a lot different deal. They probably take you in and get an X-ray and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's a different day and age. And I think they protect the player more. And I think that's, at that time, you know, guys were, I mean, I know I grew up, hey, rub a little dirt on it or your mom's going to make you come in and you know, before the sun goes down. So, different age.
His dad, my grandfather, told us a famous story that when he was a high school kid, he had a friend that played on the team and he got a concussion, and the coach of the high school team in Canton came out and tightened the kid's belt that was around his pants and said, "You're okay, get the hell back in there."
Yeah.
And I mean, I couldn't see that nowadays.
Yeah, no, somebody be sued probably.
Yeah, I think what Jeff referred to yesterday when we talked to Jeff Nixon was there was sort of a warrior attitude. You didn't want to come out, so you just kept playing, and sometimes you just felt that pressure to just keep staying in there, even though maybe your mind was telling you that probably wasn't a good idea. But I think that was sort of the warrior aspect of the game.
There's no question, and as I mentioned, it starts as a young boy. You don't want to have your peers, your friends see you, you know, go crying off and leaving. That's it. I see myself as a warrior. I don't know if it's that way today, but I felt like I was a warrior, and that was my job, to be a soldier and a warrior. And that's what I did. And I was proud of it.
Ed, last thing I want to ask you, because I know he is going into the Hall of Fame this year, and I know it probably means a whole heck of a lot to you, but I wanted to give you a chance to speak about your coach, Don Coryell, getting the chance to finally go into the Hall of Fame. What does it mean to you to see that, and what does it mean to you to finally kind of have him be in there after so many years of people saying he deserved it, to finally get that honor for him? What does that mean to you?
Well, It means a lot, because it's just a verification of what a lot of people know, what I know, and he was so special to me, and I he made me feel special. He I know he didn't want to cut me, so he hired me as an assistant coach, So that's the kind of relationship we had. And so I went from playing to coaching on his coaching staff with the Chargers. And Don was just a special guy. He had Joanne and I up to his place and up in the Puget Sound. And he was just a wonderful guy. And I can't say enough about him. And he was a genius of moving the football. And he did it, you know, the most expedient way, and that was through the air. And that was his whole philosophy was, hey, it's a lot easier to get yards throwing that ball. You would always say, throw it to Kellen. Throw it at Kellen. And I've heard that more and more. And so anyway, it means a lot to see him go in, and I'll be honed in on the television watching that.
Ed White, former San Diego Charger, former Minnesota Viking, and an artist, and so much that's touched the lives of so many. And Ed, we so appreciate you being part of the podcast tonight. Great stories, and you're welcome back anytime. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you, George.
Thanks,
good talking to you guys. And I thank you. You know, as I get older and in the Coffin Corner, which is your newsletter, which I love, every time I see the Coffin Corner, it gives me the chills. And then I open it up and look at all the guys in the past, and I go, holy cow, I see why it's called that. But anyway, I love it. Love what you guys are doing.
Oh, great. Thank you so much.
Ed, thanks all for right. joining us. Have a great night.
Take care.
Yep.
See you guys.
Thanks, Ed.
Thanks.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Hello, football friends. This is Darren Hayes of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, and I'd like to invite you to the portal of positive football history, Pigskin Dispatch and PigskinDispatch.com. We talk about everything that centers around the game of American football, expert discussions, the origins of the games, the great players, teams, and coaches, and more, and some great guests and insights from experts. We have new episodes 3 to 4 times a week, and you can find us on SportsHistoryNetwork.com, PigskinDispatch.com, or your favorite podcast provider.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.